loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we look at the big stories of the week in our segment called The Week in Review. We'll be discussing the polar vortex's effect on the homeless in the upper Midwest and around the country, and on all people. We're going to talk about the candidates for the 2020 presidential candidate, including recently announced candidacies. And we're going to be talking about a new court decision related to Julian Assange. All of that and more here on Loud and Clear.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo announced this morning that the United States would withdraw from the 1987 Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, a major arms control treaty with Russia, ending a cornerstone Cold War agreement by claiming that Russia has already violated it. The withdrawal takes effect in 6 months and threatens to set off a global arms race. Next, the Senate voted 68-23 yesterday to approve an amendment expressing strong opposition to President Trump's decision to withdraw troops from Syria and to draw down the American presence in Afghanistan. The vote is veto-proof and is a direct challenge to the president's decision to bring the troops home. Then, Immigration and Customs Enforcement officials admitted yesterday that they have been force-feeding 6 detained immigrants who went on a hunger strike to protest conditions at the Texas Detention Center where they are being held. A total of 15 immigrants are on hunger strikes, and most complain that they are being brutalized by ICE officers. And then, as preparations are underway for a historic second summit between Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un later this month, the United States may be softening its negotiating position in the hopes of reaching a deal. Meanwhile, the country's top intelligence officials told Congress earlier this week that North Korea likely will not give up its nuclear capabilities in an attempt to undermine these crucial upcoming talks. And finally, we'll look at the worst, most misleading, funniest, and the just plain wrong headlines of the past week. And in other headlines, President Trump said today in reference to the negotiations in Congress, we're not getting anywhere with them. And then about the border wall, I think there's a good chance we'll have to do that. The current funding for the federal government will keep it open until February 15th or for 2 more weeks. Italian Deputy Foreign Minister Manlio Di Stefano said today that Italy will not recognize Juan Guaido, the head of the National Assembly in Venezuela, as the president after his coup attempt against Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. The European Parliament has come out in favor of Guaido, but the European Union itself has not come out one way or the other. Vice Media will cut 10% of its jobs, the company announced today, which is about 250 people. The company is valued as high as $5.7 billion and operates in 40 countries. This comes just days after BuzzFeed cut about 200 jobs, which is approximately 12% of their workforce, and Huffington Post laid off 10% of their employees, or about 20 people. The death toll from the capsized boats off the coast of Somalia has risen to 58, according to the International Organization for Migration. Around 15 were pulled to safety, but estimates for one boat is about 130 people on board. So many remain missing. Those are today's headlines, and you are listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
It's time for our weekly segment called The Week in Review. We'll talk about the week in politics, policy, and international affairs with Jacqueline Lookman, who joins us here in the studio. She's the editor-in-chief of Lookman Nation. You can check out their live stream every week on Facebook and YouTube. And we're joined in studio by Sputnik News analyst and producer Walter Smolarek. Jackie, Walter, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Happy to be here.
Well, let's talk about the issues, the big issues of the week. Of course, it's been very, very cold in big parts of the country. I want to talk in this segment about what's been happening to people who are homeless. And homelessness, of course, is rampant in America, the biggest economy in the world, the so-called richest country in the world. Huge number of people living without permanent shelter, as we've talked about in the past. One out of every 10 children in the New York City public schools, one out of every 10 is homeless. That's 114,000 kids. And many of them have parents who are, in fact, employed and working, but still can't afford a permanent home. But before we get to the issue of how the homeless have fared during this polar vortex, I want to play an audio clip from Rachel Maddow, of course, and MSNBC, because Rachel is trying to help us understand why it got so cold this week. And, you know, that's a question that's on everybody's mind. How, it's the middle of winter, but how could it be that it got so darn cold? Anyway, let's listen to what Rachel Maddow has to say about it.
The director of national intelligence telling us all in unclassified form in black and white, China and Russia can do this today, now, whenever they want to. In other words, we're relying on their good graces that they're not. And it is like negative 50 degrees in the Dakotas right now. What would happen if Russia killed the power in Fargo today? Right? What would happen if all the natural gas lines that service Sioux Falls just poofed on the coldest day in recent memory, and it wasn't in our power whether or not to turn them back on? I mean, what would you do if you lost heat indefinitely as the act of a foreign power on the same day the temperature in your front yard matched the temperature in Antarctica? I mean, what would you and your family do?
You, Jackie, I'm sure when I hear that clip, I'm thinking to myself, the people who don't have power right now, this in the last 2 weeks, and the people who are cold, especially the homeless, they're probably thinking, well, I'm just so glad I'm not cold because of Russia, because that would be a fundamental threat to our national security and to my personal security.
Yes, let's not hold our current and allegedly democratic government accountable for not providing quality and affordable housing for people so that we don't have to hear about 20 people freezing to death in the Midwest. Let's make this about Russia freezing our gas lines.
Freezing to death. We are the wealthiest country in the world, and we have people freezing to death.
Freezing to death, and you've got someone who is on arguably one of the most watched, quote-unquote, left-ish leaning media outlets in the country, blaming Russia and China.
You know, Walter, when I was a young person and a young socialist person,
20 years ago, right?
10 years ago. And I watched a lot of the film clips, the old film clips from the House of Un-American Activities Committee and from the Senate hearings with Joe McCarthy, because I was just sort of fascinated. It seemed like ancient history, even though it was actually just 20 years from when I was watching them. Rachel Maddow sounds like Joe McCarthy. I mean, it sounds like a lunatic, like what we now characterize as the lunatic sort of part of the Cold War.
Yeah, the fringe.
They're coming at our power grid. Just think if you're cold, just think how bad it would be if the Russians do what they want to do, or the Chinese.
Yeah, and it's based on absolutely nothing, right? It's 100% speculative. And then if there's, you know, I mean, there's the absurdity of it on the surface. And then when you go a little bit beneath the surface, there's some like extremely dangerous, scary things that are being implied there. I mean, one, it's that, you know, well, so Rachel Maddow started out by citing, you know, our great intelligence agencies. And look, the intelligence heads are saying an open committee in black and white. So, you know, there's this one, the reinforcement of this idea that the word of, you know, the CIA and the NSA and the FBI is absolute unquestionable truth. And in fact, if you do question it, well, maybe you're a Russian agent or a Chinese agent. And then, I mean, the very formulation, right? Russia and China are able to do this. Russia and China, Russia and China, Russia and China. Well, that's the Pentagon talking point. I mean, that's the national security strategy, security, quote unquote, that they put out saying that, look, this century is going to be defined by us going after China and Russia. And by the way, in case people forgot, they have lots and lots of nuclear weapons. So, I mean, the idea that the century will be defined by this great power competition, quote unquote, is something that's so profoundly dangerous. And the function of Rachel Maddow, even though it was usually people who are affiliated with the Republican Party doing these types of things in the past, like Joe McCarthy, now it's, you know, Rachel Maddow, who presented herself for a big part of her career as sort of the liberal progressive wing of the Democratic Party, now serving essentially the same function as Joe McCarthy for the intelligence agencies and for the Pentagon.
Yeah, and I can't help but think that her whole narrative that millions and millions of Americans are going to pick up on now, not to say that you shouldn't be prepared for whatever disaster might possibly come, because to be honest, we do. You don't want to see what's underneath our stairs in our house as far as bottled water and canned goods, just in case. But just the fact that this whole narrative takes away from the antiquated energy system that we do have in this country, that, okay, if you want to make the argument that our power grid is vulnerable to anything, it's just that it's insufficient. It's antiquated. It is not based on renewable energy. It's based on fossil fuels, which makes it unreliable and incredibly expensive for most people anyway. So people, poor people, especially, and especially people in rural areas, are relying on energy from a system that is just outdated and already faulty that they can't rely on as it is. That's not Russia or China's fault.
Yeah, go ahead, Walter.
Yeah, of course, the infrastructure is completely terrible. So, right, maybe we can blame some of the, you know, utility companies. You know, maybe we could blame landlords and real estate speculators rather than Russia and China for why people are starving out in the cold, because the price of housing, especially in major cities, has just skyrocketed over the past, you know, 10 years, 20 years. I mean, it's a long-term trend, but it's just completely unaffordable in so many cities. And so, yeah, of course, there's a homelessness crisis and there's just no provisions at all for people. And you know what? The city governments are completely unhelpful in many regards. Like in Philadelphia, there was a theater that opened its doors to the homeless population over the last few days because of the freeze. And then the city government sent licenses and inspections office, employees down there to say, well, you know, you guys aren't allowed to have people staying in here. That's like against the zoning code. And they shut it down. And now they're not allowed to provide shelter for homeless people.
Yeah. John, I was looking at the headlines this morning. It was one of those supposedly feel-good headlines, but it didn't make me feel good. It says, Good Samaritan buys 70-plus hotel rooms so that the homeless could actually go to a hotel for a night or two. And I'm thinking, like, what does that say about the country?
Well, I think it says a couple of things. It says that we're morally bankrupt, first of all. And what about the other 79,930 homeless people in Chicago? Brian, I think this problem goes back almost a century. It was the Republican Party that fought the creation of Social Security. It's the Republican Party that fought the creation of Medicare and Medicaid. They fought the New Deal. They fought the Square Deal. They fought the Great Society. We don't have a complete social safety net in this country because the Republican Party has never wanted a social safety net. And then when things get bad, like with this polar vortex, we have to grapple with hundreds of thousands of at-risk homeless people all across the country.
I hear you about the Republicans. We'll never forget that the Republicans were vociferously against unemployment insurance and the Social Security Act of 1935. When Medicare came up in 1964 for a vote, the Republicans filibustered.
Mm-hmm.
Just like they said, they say now, well, if we have Medicare for all, it'll bankrupt the country. That's what they said about Medicare for elderly people in 1964. Then it happened, and now all elderly people are looking forward to the fact that they're actually going to have health care once they turn 65 years of age. It's not free. It's not perfect, but it exists. But it's not just the Republicans. I mean, you now have heard Democratic candidates saying over and over again, and President Obama, when he had control of the House and the Senate in 2009, 2010, he said Medicare for all is off the table, even though most Americans, one, were for it, and two, even if they weren't for it, once they had it, they would benefit from it. In other words, it's a winning combination for people. Anyway, go ahead, Jackie.
Yeah, I mean, we think we have this opposition party in the Democrats, but they're not, and they haven't been for a long time. They not only, like we argue here so often, they not only don't do a good job making the case for their alleged opposition, but they really don't get behind policies that their own base wants. I mean, as much as we can oppose the Republican Party for actually opposing people-focused policies, at least they stay on message. You know, they are good with their messaging, as horrible as the message is. The Democrats can't even muster up a good message for fighting for their own base. They're very mealy-mouthed about bipartisanship and reaching across the aisle, but they rarely ever make a case for just standing up for what people need and free and affordable housing for the homeless, Medicare for all. I mean, if we don't have politicians who can make that case, not to the Republicans, but to the American people, exactly for what you said, Brian, for, okay, fine, you might not like it, but imagine if you never have to worry about a medical bill for at least preventative care. Imagine if you never have to worry about whether veterans are homeless. Imagine if you don't have to worry about 1 in 10 children in New York City, probably one of the wealthiest cities in this country, being homeless. imagine what else all of that worry frees up for you, just in your imagination, and think about the people who have to live with that. If they don't have to worry about that, what else can they do? That we don't have candidates who can even do that.
That's the voice of Jacqueline Lookman. She's with the Lookman Nation. She joins us every Wednesday and Friday in two segments. One is called In the News. That's on Wednesday, where we take a look at the stories midweek. And then this segment, which goes for 1 hour and 2 half-hour segments, called The Week in Review. We're also joined by Walter Smolarek. He is a Sputnik News analyst and a producer of this show. Walter, you were going to jump in.
Yeah. Well, I think that's an extremely important point, because I think, you know, one thing that people would probably do is get more involved in the political life of the country, in the political life of their community, maybe at their union, at their job. Maybe they would feel the confidence to start a union at their job, because, you know, they wouldn't be, you know, just a paycheck away from total destitution if there was a serious social safety net here in the United States. So I think it's definitely related to the question of political power. Power in society as well. Another thing, you know, the Republicans certainly are like leading the charge when it comes to austerity. I mean, they're sort of setting the tone and putting out all the sort of quote unquote like bold proposals, like privatizing Social Security, right? Which I think was their plan in 2004, like a few years before the stock market collapsed. So if they had succeeded with that, it would have been magnified the crisis even more. But the Democrats actually, in addition to providing like insufficient opposition, are also really in favor of a lot of those cuts, I think. I mean, during the Clinton administration, it was probably the most obvious with the, you know, the end of welfare as we know it, as they put it. You know, kicking, you know, hundreds of thousands, I think millions of children off of food stamps. And then there was, you know, during the Obama administration, they were ready to make like serious cuts to sort of the most important social programs in the country as part of the sort of like fiscal cliff debt ceiling negotiations in like 2011, 2012. There is like, you know, one of those like gangs in Congress that came together and put forward a set of, you know, bipartisan proposals. I think it was the Simpson-Bowles Commission. And so, yeah, I mean, that would have been, if the Republicans would have actually passed it, if they weren't so extreme that they wouldn't have even passed that, been like a serious blow to working people too.
And I think I just want to add really quick that we've got current Democratic politicians who are trying to destroy a country, Venezuela, that doesn't have these problems because of this evil socialism that our own elected officials refuse to provide here. But we're trying to impose our style of democracy on them.
I want to come back to Venezuela a little bit later, and we'll talk about there is a profound economic crisis in Venezuela. We want to talk about the roots of it, and also Juan Guaido, who has been handpicked by Mike Pence and Donald Trump and John Bolton to be the president. He announced his economic program yesterday, which is basically to privatize the entire country, and especially the oil company oil in Venezuela, that's 95% of the national treasury. Again, we're going to talk about that a little bit later, though, in the segment. I want to stay, before we leave, on both the Democratic Party, because there's a bunch of new announcements about who are the contenders for the 2020 campaign. But before we do that, I want to go back to Chicago and the homeless issue for a moment. And then on the polar vortex. Again, it relates to the Democrats, too, because, you know, the mayor in Chicago is a Democrat, right? Here's from the Washington Post about the polar vortex now and what Chicago did for the homeless. Now, you can see in the headlines that the Chicago administration was bragging about its compassionate outreach to the homeless. Here's from the Washington Post. For the region's most vulnerable, even those hardened to the upper Midwest's long winters, the polar vortex has been especially perilous. Karen Andrew, director of Hope's Home Ministries at the United Methodist Church in Madison, has spent much of the past few days coordinating with other nonprofits and government agencies to arrange transportation, hot meals, and warming centers for the city's homeless residents. Then here's the kicker, and this is in Madison. It's also was happening all over the Midwest. Here you get the homeless. They've been brought in because of the outreach from the different cities. Early Wednesday morning, there remained a small but dangerous gap in service. An hour before sunrise, dozens of men, bundled up and carrying their belongings in grocery bags and suitcases, ventured into the frigid morning air. It was minus 24 degrees, and winds made it feel like minus 48. Then the story goes on. The people who were in the shelter had to wake up at 5:30 in the morning, take all of their life's possessions, all of them, and walk 6 blocks. Now, 6 blocks doesn't sound long, but do that with all of your life's possessions, when it's minus 48 degrees below zero wind chill. And this is America. I mean, you have a country that spends $1 trillion a year. That's the real number on weapons, on death and destruction. But when it comes to the homeless or it comes to poor people or low income people, there's never enough money. And again, I want to just highlight this because all of the cities in the, especially the liberal and democratic cities in the Midwest, we're saying we're doing something compassionate for the homeless. The problem really isn't actually the elected officials, even though they're to blame. The problem is the way this society is organized. There's no part of the American society that says we are responsible to make sure that everyone has the right to shelter, that we make sure that everyone has the right to food. In fact, those ideas are called socialism, and they mean socialism as an insult.
Anytime you have the international community, I think the United Nations declared housing a human right. And the United States was like one of the few countries that did not sign on to that resolution. It is not hard to see that our idea of democracy isn't, it's not democracy, it's capitalism. It's capitalism. It's predatory capitalism. I mean, we can make the argument for and against capitalism all we want to, but in these cities where we see this growing homeless crisis, Chicago, Washington, D.C., Los Angeles, Philadelphia, you also see this growth in gentrification, pushing poor people out of already marginalized communities. And a lot of those people don't have anywhere to go. You also see in those communities an existing lack of mental health services, an existing lack of substance abuse services. So where there are all of these cracks, where this society that's supposed to be free has not provided for the basic needs, the basic human needs of its people, and it's all because of money.
Let's go on to some of these Democratic Party candidates, and there's others too, running as an independent, Howard Schultz from CEO of Starbucks, another billionaire entering the race.
And a lifelong Democrat who says he's running, he wants to run as an independent because the Democrats are just too liberal.
Yeah, that's the problem. Anyway, Kamala Harris, former Attorney General of California, someone who immediately upon leaving law school became a prosecutor, which, I mean,
that's a deal breaker for me right
that
there.
That doesn't sound like an idealistic law student. Like, let me immediately start my law practice by sending people to jail. Anyway, I want to play an audio clip. It's her speaking before the very well-heeled Commonwealth Club from several years ago, because Kamala Harris is also getting a lot of traction and being presented as a liberal new sort of voice and face for the Democratic Party. Again, she was Attorney General of California. She was the DA in San Francisco, a quick rise to fame. Anyway, let's listen to her speaking before the Commonwealth Club. This was in 2010.
I would not be standing here were it not for the education I received. And I know many of us will say the same thing. And I believe a child going without an education is tantamount to a crime. So I decided I was going to start prosecuting parents for truancy. Well, this was a little controversial in San Francisco. And frankly, my staff went bananas. They were very concerned because we didn't know at the time whether I was going to have an opponent in my reelection race.
Wow. That says a lot. That says a lot.
Very cold-hearted.
And again, the consideration was not about sending parents, working class and poor people, because it's just really about working class and poor people, to jail because their kid didn't come to school. Her main concern was whether it would impact her political fortunes in liberal San Francisco. Go ahead, Jackie.
Yeah, this whole video, it's this video and another video, and I think you can find them on YouTube. They're floating around, certainly on social media, is so repulsive. This, to me, is like on the level of Hillary Clinton's super predator. It is just like super predator 2010 with a black face. I said it. Yes, I did. So it's just when you listen to the rest of this video, Harris goes on to say something like, you know, we found this case, these kinds of cases where this one particular woman was holding down two or three jobs and her kid wasn't going to school.
And she had three children.
Yeah, she had three kids and she just needed some help. So what did Harris do for this woman who needed some help? She charged her. So the idea that the system can't help people like this woman who has three jobs, single mom, doesn't have any help, and her kids are probably working trying to help their mom out, so they're missing school, taking care of their little brother or sister. The only way the system can identify and help these people is to threaten them with jail time. That is just the most, one of the most evil things that I've heard from a politician in a while.
Yeah, and she went on to say, Walter, well, if the kids, one of the kids did better in school after her parents were charged with a crime, and so that showed that her program of arresting parents for kids' truancy was working, and then she would, quote, drop the charges. I mean, you know, poor people, working class people, single moms in this case, multiple kids, you have to worry. You have to stress. I'm going to go to jail. You have to get a lawyer. I mean, the system is stacked against you. I mean, and the way she was talking, it was kind of laughing before the Commonwealth Club, and like it was kind of an in-joke, and you all understand this is going to be potentially politically unpopular, but I consider not getting an education to be a crime. Well, Kamala Harris and all the other people running for president actually come from well-heeled backgrounds. Anyway, there's a war in America, Walter. It's against poor people, and it's by rich people.
Yeah, and the implication is that, oh, well, you know, poor people are poor because they're just irresponsible. They won't send their children to school. You know, they won't meet, you know, their basic responsibilities as parents. And it's the same narrative that led to, you know, like I was mentioning before, the gutting of welfare in the 1990s, you know, all of the social safety net programs being destroyed in the 1980s and 90s and 2000s. You know, it's the same narrative that, you know, if you're poor, it's because you're irresponsible. And therefore, if you're rich, it's because you're just so smart and you just have such good values and your character is so wonderful that you're just born to rule society. I mean, it's sort of like a new version of like the divine right of kings, but it's personal responsibility.
That's Walter Smolarek. He's a Sputnik news analyst and a producer of this show. We're also joined in studio by Jacqueline Lookman. She is the editor-in-chief of the Lookman Nation. You can check out their live stream every week on Facebook and YouTube. We're talking about The Week in Review. The big stories after a short break. We'll continue this discussion.
Loud and clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
It's Friday. That means it's time to talk about the big issues of the week in this segment called The Week in Review. We talk about the week in politics, policy, and international affairs with Jacqueline Lookman, who joins us here in the studio. She is the editor-in-chief of Lookman Nation. You can check out their live stream every week on Facebook and YouTube. And we're joined in studio by Sputnik News analyst and producer Walter Smolarek. Welcome back, guys.
Thanks for having me.
Happy to be here.
All right. The Senate swung into action, John. They swung into action this week because they sensed a grave danger that the president of the United States might actually be pulling U.S. troops out of other countries.
Well, there's a serious danger of a breakout of peace in the Middle East and,
to the barricades.
And Central Asia. Yes. And the vote in the Senate was 68-23. That's a veto-proof vote. This was not a resolution. It was an amendment. And so what we've seen now in the Senate is they've effectively already prohibited Donald Trump from withdrawing these troops if the House goes along with the same measure.
You can never get the House and the Senate to unite to stop a war. But here they're stopping the possible ending of a war.
Right.
Really something, Jackie.
It is really, really kind of shocking. Well, it's not shocking. Let me not be disingenuous. It's not shocking.
It's not just the imperial presidency. It is the imperial Congress as well.
It is the imperial Congress. And if these developments don't show people who our quote unquote elected officials really represent, it's the defense contractors. I don't know what else is going to convince people at a time when, you know, we can guess about what's really going to happen out of Russia and Syria trying to negotiate some kind of something in the region. For the United States, for our elected officials to say, no, we're going to just stick in the middle of this, stay in the middle of this, and keep it confused and messy and not just let them deal with this situation, it's unconscionable, but it's not as surprising as I'd like to sometimes think it is.
Well, let's talk about the vote. Some of the Democrats did vote against the majority here. That would include Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, Kirsten Gillibrand. They voted no. This was a Republican measure. This was McConnell.
Yeah, the Republicans were united in this, which is very, very rare. It's very unusual. But every single Republican in the Senate voted for this.
By the way, it was an amendment to the bill that would strengthen the criminalization of the BDS Act or of the BDS movement as well.
Well, people might not know what BDS stands for.
Yeah, yeah. So BDS is Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions. It's an international movement to put pressure on Israel through the tactics of boycott, divestment, and sanctions to end the occupation of Palestine, to, you know, permit Palestinians to return to their historic homeland and to recognize Palestinian equal civil human rights. And so, you know, there's a bill in Congress that would do a number of things. One was to sort of strengthen state laws that make it a crime to support the BDS movement. And it's that law that this amendment that seeks to sort of cement the U.S. presence in Syria and Afghanistan is an amendment to. So they have this sort of like omnibus imperialism bill that everybody seems to support, at least in the Senate. We don't know about the House yet, but I suspect that the House will also support this measure. Yeah, I mean, it's something that shows you, you know, where are the limits, like what are the red lines of the U.S. political system? Because, you know, you're allowed to debate certain things like abortion rights, right? You know, that, even though it's something about like women's own bodies, you know, that's totally on the table. You can have whatever position you want on that. But on the question of war and peace, on the question of should the United States be the dominant hegemonic power that can impose its will on every other country in the world, you can't really disagree with that. And even those Democrats who voted no, I don't think they would fundamentally challenge that notion either. They might just have other sort of particularistic objections.
Well, they're running for office. And actually, what Trump is doing would be popular with big parts of the electorate, withdrawing from Syria and Afghanistan. Certainly, if Bernie Sanders votes against that, weakens him with progressive people who want U.S. forces to be out of these countries. Walter mentioned something interesting. He said, well, you can debate things like abortion rights, but it's in the Congress. But, you know, it's interesting that Congress actually didn't pass legislation giving women the right to choose. It was a Supreme Court decision. And so 9 unelected judges voting 7-2 during the Nixon era did Roe v. Wade. You know, again, you have the U.S. Congress as a bastion of reaction.
Oh, my gosh. And it has been for generations. And here we are again in the second decade, at the end of the second decade of the 21st century. And we're still relying on the courts to correct policy errors made in the Congress.
And you can't, I mean, from a progressive point of view, I mean, given the fact that Trump is stacking the courts with right-wing judges, and even, by the way, having run into a few of the Obama judges in litigation that I was involved in, they weren't so hot either.
No way. That's,
I'm putting it mildly. But now Trump is stacking the courts with Federalist Society, right-wing, ultra-right-wing judges, Supreme Court stacked against any progressive rulings. We have a situation where all of these so-called checks and balances are not a check and balance against the other branches of government. They're a check and a balance, but particularly a check against anything good happening. That's what I think. That's what America's checks and balances. Let's make sure nothing good happens for people.
Yeah, I mean, what they really are checks and balances against the free expression of the American people to disagree with its government, to advocate for ourselves, to demand of our elected officials that they work for us. I mean, this whole, Walter mentioned the BDS legislation. I mean, I really can't get my head around, other than the other group that actually controls our legislature being outside of defense contractors, also being the Israeli government, I cannot get my head around these elected officials who call themselves Democrats who would vote for such a piece of legislation that criminalizes and allows states to punish people for saying, I'm not going to support a business, a private business that does business with a country's government that openly oppresses people. And the justification always being, you know, the typical talking points. But I thought we had free speech in this country.
Well, there was a scandal just a couple of weeks ago in Texas where a Palestinian American teacher was told that she had to sign a document saying that she would not boycott, divest, or support sanctions against Israel in order to keep her job. And she refused to sign that document, and she was fired. Now, she was not asked to sign a document pledging her allegiance to the United States. It was that she would protect the economic and political interests of Israel and lost her job for it.
Yeah, hurricane victims in Texas couldn't get a FEMA relief without signing that thing saying that they won't participate in a boycott, meaning the boycott
of, this is insanity,
of Israel. Again, you had also a federal judge ruling that boycotts aren't protected speech. That was last week. Yes, they are. Boycotts are protected speech. I mean, the courts have been clear about that. You know, Martin Luther King Jr. wrote that famous letter from the Birmingham jail, right? And everybody is told, look to Martin Luther King, the letter to the Birmingham jail, the bad old days when people of conscience like Martin Luther King did what was necessary. They went up against power, and ultimately they helped the country evolve into a better place, right? Martin Luther King Jr. was in jail in the Birmingham jail. One of his charges was for boycott because they were boycotting businesses that maintained policies of segregation, including public institutions. This was pre-1964 Civil Rights Act, when it was not illegal to use segregation and the banning of black people from access to public services like public transportation. So Martin Luther King Jr. was in jail and wrote the letter from the Birmingham jail because he was part of a boycott to undo an unjust law. And now the Israelis who are killing the Israeli government and the IDF, which is occupying illegally Palestinian lands, killing Palestinian people with impunity, when people want to resist that, not by force of arms, not by an armed struggle, because remember, the PLO was always called terrorist because it used arms in the armed struggle. So now the Palestinians are using nonviolent methods called the boycott, and that's considered to be another form of terrorism. I mean, so the only thing the Palestinians can do, apparently, is nothing. All they can do is get down on their knees and submit or allow this slow motion genocide or eviction of their people from their historic ancestral lands to take place without, you know, without speaking up. Because if you can't protest violently through armed struggle and you can't protest nonviolently, what other options actually are there?
There's absolutely nothing that the Palestinians can do to resist, whether it's, you know, the nonviolent sort of civil society BDS effort, whether it's the armed struggle, whether it's the heroic demonstrations that are taking place on a weekly basis and have for almost a year now along the border between Gaza and Israel protesting the blockade. No matter what, the mainstream media, you know, the establishment politicians, they'll always say, oh, well, they're terrorists, or they're anti-Semitic, or, you know, the Israel is the only democracy in the region, and these people hate human rights and democracy. So there's all sorts of excuses that you can come up with. But at the end of the day, the fundamental truth is that because of the role that Israel plays in the Middle East, because of its utility to the United States as a proxy that is highly, highly unlikely to be overthrown by its own people, unlike all of their other proxies in the Middle East. And as I think a secondary factor, the strength of the pro-Israel lobby in the United States. Yeah, I mean, this is going to be what's dominant. But it's pretty remarkable that it's losing the battle of public opinion. Not to say that pro-Palestinian sentiment is like the majority now. It's not, but the trend is in its favor. It's very clearly and demonstrably in its favor. And that's reflected in the documents of those pro-Israel lobbying organizations.
In this Arkansas court ruling that criminalizes BDS, the case is actually from a newspaper. It's the Arkansas Times. Now, here's a newspaper. Remember the First Amendment, freedom of press?
Right.
So this newspaper was suing the state because the state ruled because the newspaper had a business relationship with a college and the college received public funds, it would be subject to the state law, and the state law criminalizes participation in the BDS. So the Arkansas Times was required to sign a statement saying that they would not participate in a boycott or be in contact with businesses that supported the boycott, divest, sanctions movement. And Arkansas Times said, we are the media. We don't have to sign this waiver. We don't have to sign this pledge. And the court, the federal district court judge said, yes, you do, because a boycott is not protected by the courts as a free speech thing. Now, clearly the Supreme Court says it is. That's been established law. But nonetheless, if every organization, every company, now every newspaper, which the authorities say you must sign this pledge, if they have to get a lawyer, if they have to go to court, if they have to spend limited resources, they're going to think twice about what to do regarding this actual movement or the businesses or the business contracts they sign with different entities.
And the logic of the BDS movement is to put economic pressure on people who are supportive, or either directly or indirectly, if it's an investment fund, for instance, that invests in a weapons contractor that sells goods to Israel, right? Like, all of these things are you deciding to withhold your own money. You know what I mean? I mean, this is it's pretty remarkable that all the right wing politicians who talk about private property and how important would rail against taxes or government spending are supporting this like very draconian law that actually kind of tells you like where you have to buy from. I mean, even it's not saying like you buy from X business or Y business. It's sort of saying like here's a very specific and explicitly political regulation determining like what you do with your own resources.
And these are the same group of people, though, who set fire to all of their Nike gear when, and yeah, vowed to never support Nike again.
You are absolutely
when
right.
When they hired Colin Kaepernick for their, so the hypocrisy it's pretty glaring.
Let's go back to some of the candidates. We have new announcements. Cory Booker, Jackie, has announced his campaign for presidency. Now that's after Elizabeth Warren. Tulsi Gabbard is going to announce formally this week, I believe.
Yeah, tomorrow.
Weekend.
Actually, before we talk about Booker, Tulsi Gabbard's already in trouble. She is going to make her formal announcement tomorrow, Saturday, but her campaign manager resigned today and her polling company also quit and they've been replaced by her sister. So the campaign is already in very serious trouble.
What? So I'm curious. I'm very curious as to why. Why now? The timing is
she's
really
running for vice
strange.
President. That's what this is. I think her calculation is that if she can remain relevant through the first round of primaries and caucuses, maybe get as far as South Carolina, which is the third, that she would be the go-to vice presidential candidate. I think that's what her calculation is. She's only 37 years old. She's only been eligible to run for president for 2 years.
For 2 years, yeah. Well,
Tulsi Gabbard is not going to be anyone's vice presidential candidate. That's my feeling.
Because, yeah, I think you're right.
Because the political establishment in the United States is, I think, committed to actually destroying Tulsi Gabbard. Now, you can find different reasons to criticize Tulsi Gabbard, but the thing that's driving the establishment crazy is that she met with Assad.
Right.
She's an opponent of the earlier U.S. efforts to topple the Assad government. Her position is, whatever you think about Bashar al-Assad, the replacement of that government by, say, al-Qaeda or the Nusra Front or whatever you want, mm-hmm. whatever they want to call itself, or ISIS is going to be worse for
the people
of Syria.
Bad. Yes.
So she went up against the U.S. consensus on the Assad must go. She has also had a pretty traditionally consistent anti-war position. So I don't think any candidate will pick her because she will be considered toxic by the political establishment, the ones who vet who's going to actually be able to run successfully.
It's an ugly truth that the DNC picks the nominee. And they do that through the system of superdelegates. Now, although there are some minor reforms that will take place in advance of the next presidential election, the party bosses still essentially control the path to the nomination. And so I think that it's impossible to see a George McGovern-style insurgent candidate end up winning the nomination. The fix is in. It just can't happen anymore.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I think this influx of candidates, I think it's a good thing that there are as many candidates running as there are.
I agree.
Everyone run. I think no other country has collapsed under the weight of having lots of choices in a democratic election. So within a party, it certainly isn't going to hurt the Democratic Party. It's not going to hurt the United States. I think it's a great thing. The quality of these candidates is, of course, an issue. Most of them on several issues are terrible. Schultz is terrible.
He's absolutely
he's terrible.
Kirsten Gillibrand is terrible.
Is terrible. Cory Booker, unless you are from New Jersey, you don't know how terrible he is. But he's friends with Chris Christie. I mean, he's literally friends with Chris Christie.
I didn't know that.
Yes, and there is a very smarmy history between Booker and Christie and Sharp James. And Booker is basically the reason that Chris Christie was able to go after Sharp James. Then, you know, there is also the relationship between Cory Booker, Mark Zuckerberg, and that disastrous $100 million pumped into New Jersey Charter School. So, you know, there's all this history behind Booker that people outside of New Jersey who don't pay attention to politics don't know a lot about.
Chris Christie actually said something this morning that is specifically on point. He says that the articulate Cory Booker would be a formidable challenger to Donald Trump.
Oh, that is not a ringing endorsement. I'm sorry. That's just that coming from Chris Christie, who I imagined him sitting expectantly in front of his phone. Remember when Trump was waiting to call announce who
Attorney
his vice
general.
Vice president. And he did. I just imagined how dejected he was when he didn't get that call. Chris Christie started out as a very popular governor of New Jersey, but his own corruption eventually caught up with him, got the best of him. And it eventually all came out. Booker is inextricably tied to Chris Christie, and he's not all that popular in New Jersey. Cory Booker is, so he's a terrible candidate.
And, you know, if you look at the other candidates, like, so there's Kamala Harris. I think she has been getting probably the most favorable coverage in the corporate media.
Without a doubt.
Both in terms of, like, the quantity of coverage that she got and also, like, the political tone of it. I mean, she's somebody who is, you know, a complete gung-ho committed person when it comes to mass incarceration. She was the attorney general of San Francisco and then of the state of California, where there are huge numbers of people in prison in horrible conditions. A lot of them were sent there by Kamala Harris. And then there's Elizabeth Warren, right, who, you know, is sort of trying to take the posture of, oh, well, I'm part of the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. I'm kind of like Bernie Sanders, but a little bit less scary. But I mean, when you look at like what she's actually proposing, like, yeah, sure, there's some, you know, she's for more social programs than most of them are. On international issues, I think she's, you know, just as right wing as most Republicans. And then this sort of the way that she presents her politics too, or a way that's it's so clear that what she's trying to do is sort of like mollify people into sort of having faith in the system again. Like there's the Responsible Capitalism Act where, you know, it would have some like progressive reforms in there too, but it's all phrased like, oh, this system can be fine and it can be actually good for middle-class people, right? She tends to not talk about poor and working-class people. Definitely not like using the word working class. But we just need to make a couple tweaks around the edges.
That was the voice of Walter Smolarek. He's a Sputnik news analyst and a producer of this show, Loud and Clear. We're also joined in studio by Jacqueline Lookman of the Lookman Nation. She is the editor-in-chief. We have about 7.5 minutes to go on this segment. John Kiriakou, I want to change to another issue, and it's a big issue. It's an issue we've covered. It's got huge impact, potentially, not only for the people involved and the person involved, but for society as a whole. And that's the situation with Julian Assange. Let's talk about what's new here.
There was actually a very significant, very important court decision this week relative to Julian Assange that got almost no press coverage. Judge Leonie Brinkema, about whom we've spoken at length on this show. She is a district court judge in the Eastern District of Virginia, based in Alexandria, Virginia. She made a ruling this week that was very significant. Julian's attorneys filed a motion asking Judge Brinkema to order the Justice Department to make public the charges against Julian. Remember, the Justice Department accidentally revealed last month that there are criminal charges against Julian that have been sealed and remain secret. So Judge Brinkema denied that motion yesterday, saying that she could neither confirm nor deny that there were charges against Julian, because if there were charges, they would be classified. And so she refuses to say whether or not Julian Assange has been charged with a crime.
Wow. It says a lot about what would happen if the U.S. government and the U.K. government succeed in evicting Julian Assange, arresting him. That's why what people are doing, you know, John,
it's a star chamber is what it comes down to.
It's a star chamber, and a lot's at stake, because here you have all of the media, and all of the media use Julian Assange in the WikiLeaks stories for their own coverage. And there's not one WikiLeaks story that's come out that's not true, unlike the media outlets that have used it.
Yes.
I can't point to anything that WikiLeaks has published that's untrue.
And not only that, WikiLeaks has never blown a source. Never. They have protected the identity of their sources militantly, diligently, unlike The Intercept, The Washington Post, The New York Times.
And you also have a lot of organizations who are decrying this government or that government, mainly targeted governments by the United States, for their mistreatment of journalists, etc. Well, the WikiLeaks war log, Iraq war log video release showed a U.S. helicopter pilot gunning down a Reuters journalist and many other civilians, Iraqi civilians. They're walking down the street. You see it. They're walking down the street. They're talking. And suddenly, using the cannon or machine gun from the helicopter, they start blowing these people away. I talked to one of the soldiers who was on the scene, who's now a retired, you know, he's a veteran now. He's no longer active duty. He's there. He's one of the people who rescued one of the two children. Two of the kids who are in a car, they're also, they have these gaping wounds. These are like 5-year-olds, 7-year-olds, because the helicopter pilot, the American helicopter pilot, is just machine gunning like crazy. I think about 12 or 14 innocent people, journalists and civilians, killed. Now, we know about that because of WikiLeaks. Again, Chelsea Manning helped release those videos. Chelsea Manning went to prison, now, you know, out on pardon or on clemency by the Obama administration. But the source of the problem from the point of view of the U.S. is Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. The people who committed those war crimes, they are not in jail. They are not going to be in jail. They're not going to be in trial. So Julian Assange is going to be hauled, if they can get their hands on him, hauled before a grand jury and not getting a fair trial. Clearly, as the judge in this case reveals, not a fair trial.
No.
Julian Assange would go to prison for a long, long time. John, again, with your own story, I mean, you blew the whistle, meaning you exposed publicly the fact that the CIA torture program. So the torturers did not go to jail.
No, none of them.
You went to jail. And that's the message that the U.S. government wants to send. It's not because Julian Assange is an agent of a foreign power. They don't want people to come forward and reveal the truth about crimes committed by the U.S. government or people acting on its behalf.
In fact, after my arrest, administration officials, these are Obama administration officials, told the New York Times that the point of my arrest was to chill any other would-be whistleblower. That the idea wasn't necessarily to incarcerate me for any great length of time. It was to frighten anybody else who may have been thinking about going public with revelations. There's one calculation that the government has made incorrectly. They can prosecute Julian Assange. They can give him a draconian sentence. It's not going to have any effect on WikiLeaks. WikiLeaks isn't going to go away. WikiLeaks is everywhere. There is no head of WikiLeaks. It's everywhere. And it'll continue to function. It'll continue to be a repository for information that ought to be transparent and public.
John, you and I were on the online vigil for Julian Assange. Joe Loria from Consortium News is organizing it now. A lot of great people come on that. There's going to be another one today between 4 and 7 p.m. for people who want to find it. It's the online vigil for Julian Assange. I'm going to be on today. And John, I believe you've been on for the last several weeks and have been there from the beginning. What's important about this is that when Julian Assange is fighting against the power, and this is the power, he needs support from we the people. And again, the government is trying to create the sense of inevitability that they've got it. Julian Assange is cornered. They will succeed. But guess what? The people of the world believe in the idea that we should hear the truth. And WikiLeaks, to the extent that it has been the messenger and the instrument and the mechanism for providing the truth, should be defended. So I think these online vigils and other activities in defense of Julian Assange, which is really in defense of our own rights to listen and hear the truth, they can make a difference. John, 20 seconds left. Take us out.
Yeah, we can't abandon Julian Assange now because that's what the government wants us to do. They want us to just give up and say, well, it's a lost cause. We gave it a good fight. We lost. It's over. It's not over.
That's all the time we have. We've been talking with Jacqueline Lookman. She is the editor-in-chief of Lookman Nation. You can check out their live stream every week on Facebook and YouTube. And we were joined in studio by Sputnik News analyst and producer Walter Smolarek. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, communitypublicradio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.